Hey everyone, you're listening to the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Schinkel. I'm a high school educator, challenge seeker, lifelong learner, and embracer of all things messy. I find inspiration from individuals who are passionate about learning and embracing change. Join me as I share my experiences and interview people who will inspire you to embrace the messy too. Let's go. Over spring break, I took myself off of social media and school email. 2 weeks of no Instagram scrolling, no Twitter X scrolling, no Facebook scrolling, and no school Outlook emails. These are my go-to social media sinkholes. Now, I confess, in all transparency, that I did sneak on a couple of times, but only for work purposes. Like I had to check my Instagram messages for an email address I needed to quickly scroll Facebook for the year something happened because I was doing some writing. But I used the scheduling feature on both X and Facebook to schedule my usual bi-weekly Friday podcast episode drop. But even when I did that, and I had to go on momentarily, I didn't scroll the stories and I didn't go on Facebook. And by the way, my apologies to anyone's birthday I didn't comment on over those 2 weeks on Facebook, including my son who turned 24 over the break. But folks, I think he's okay that I didn't leave a corny message because I sent him a big care package and a sappy text instead of posting a gushy sentimental Facebook post. But I digress. When I finally went back onto Twitter on the final Sunday of spring break, I had 59 notifications. No shit, right? 59. But here's the hilarious thing. This made me giggle. Only 8 were actually meaningful to me. Like, the rest was just crap Elon wanted to notify me of with his stupid algorithm that I don't even understand now. And it's stuff that he just thought I might like to see. Now, I'm bringing this up because I took this sabbatical because I wanted to be happier. I have been really aware the impact phones are having on my students and the research that I'm seeing is disheartening, and it's made me reflect on my own cell phone apps scrolling use. And it's a really hard thing to do anything about it, right? Every week, my iPhone tells me how much I've been on my phone with that notification that says, you've been on your phone 23% more this week for a total of blah, blah, blah hours. And you were on your phone 11% less this week and blah, 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 blah. And I don't even like those messages because they give you a false sense of improvement. 11%, yes. Yeah, so I'm going to go on a little bit more, you know? Oh, it's so frustrating. So for the 2 weeks over spring break, I used my technology for concrete and useful purposes. That's it. I grocery shopped because, oh my God, I love delivery. I used my computer to write my podcast episode questions. You know, I did my podcast interviews over Zoom. I listened to an enormous number of podcasts in Audible, and because I am a podcast and Audible junkie. I sent my son a DoorDash dinner when he wasn't feeling well because, you know, food is love, y'all. And, you know, I connected with my friends who don't live here over FaceTime. You know, I called people. I texted more. I used it to feed my soul. I used it to feed my soul, my heart, and my body. I was using the Calm app more. I exercised more. I read more. I had more conversations. I went outside more. I puttered and organized and cleaned more. You know, I love listening to podcasts and I love listening to audiobooks, and I do all of that. And sometimes I would just shut those off too, and I would just kind of sink into whatever was going on in the atmosphere. I just, you know, I didn't go anywhere, right? But I savored this break because I think being off social media, I didn't have this chance to fixate over who was in Mexico or on a cruise and, you know, who can I be jealous of? And I didn't fall into my usual daily cute baby cat and dog video rabbit hole that usually kills anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes of my life each evening. But here's even something even more interesting about after that 2-week sabbatical from social media. Since spring break, I'm not burning to get on. Even with the apps on my phone, I only go on it when I'm set to post something about my podcast or Beyond Report Cards on Facebook, and then I'll take a peek to see what's happening and maybe make a comment, but that's it. I just don't like how I feel when I get caught in these big Twitter X thread arguments or battles online over things. It just feels like it's sucking the life out of me. I like and appreciate these small bursts of daily calm that reminds me of how awesome it felt to be off of it over the 2-week spring break. So I'm just not going to go on them as much. I'm going to do what I have to. I'm not going to deprive myself, but I'm also not going to sink into it and go down the rabbit holes anymore. So that when I go to bed at night, I'm like, yeah, I feel much better. And so I'm going to keep my social media apps, but just not go down the rabbit holes. I think my big word is disengage, right? And I'm going to disengage to feel happier.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcasts. Now let's get back to the episode.
Kim Strobel is the founder of Strobel Education. She is a motivational speaker, education consultant, and happiness coach. She is the author of Teach Happy, Small Steps to Big Joy. And as it says on her website at strobeleducation.com, I'm also a real talk, no fluff truth teller, but I haven't always been that way. In this conversation, Kim and I talk about her journey, and it's raw and it's vulnerable and it's beautiful and it's inspiring. And, you know, she just wants to fill educators with hope. And so, you know, this is a real talk, no fluff, truth-telling episode, and it'll tug at your heartstrings a bit. But you know what? It'll also give you the shot in the arm we all need this time of year. Here's my conversation with Kim Strobel. Kim Strobel, welcome to the Embrace the Messy podcast.
Oh, thank you, Shannon. I'm really excited to be here.
I just want to say that I don't know whether it was like a fate thing or a destiny thing, but given what I'm trying to do here with this podcast and even my own personal work on myself, in terms of, you know, showing gratitude and trying to not fixate on the negative and try to, you know, live happier and be present and teach happier. It felt like when I received your email and you're talking about this book that, you know, I really hate how cliche it sounds, like everything happens for a reason, but it just was so timely. And I'm so grateful that you reached out. I'm so grateful that I got to have a look at this beautiful book in advance. And it really just, it left a little imprint on my heart, Kim.
You know what? That is so kind of you. And honestly, it's exactly what I needed to hear. One of the things with writing a book, I just told my friend this morning, is, you know, at the end of the day, you just really, really, really hope that you've written something that is meaningful and impactful for our educators. And that's all I want at the end of the day. I want to know that what I produced and created is actually something that really does help them, because my heart is heavy for this profession right now.
It's a tough time, right? It's a really tough time. And we're going to dig into all of that. But first, I'm really interested in origin stories. And I would like to know, how did you decide to become a teacher? And what is your role in education now?
Oh my goodness. Well, when I first went to school at the University of Southern Indiana, and this is, you know, you read about this in the book too, but I suffered greatly from panic disorder, which I did not know what was wrong with me back in the late 80s and early 90s. We didn't know really about anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. And so when I went to school, I was actually a business major for a year, and then I quit to come back home to live with my parents because I was in a really debilitating state with my anxiety and what later was diagnosed as panic disorder, and became fearful of doing everything. And I can dig into that story a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I just could not shake the feeling then later that I was supposed to become a teacher. And so I went to work full time as a secretary at the prosecutor's office. And even though I was still dealing with these episodes and felt very fearful in my life, I decided to go back to college. And so I worked full time, and I had a boss who let me come in every morning at 4:30 in the morning. And then 3 days a week, I would leave at noon and drive 90 minutes to college. And then I would attend classes until about 10 or 11 at night. And then, you know, wake up the next morning at 4:30. And so it was 3 years of just, like, you know, being married, having to have an income still, wanting that college degree, and finally getting it and feeling like, gosh, I just loved children and loved working with children. And I couldn't wait to get my own classroom. But let me tell you what, back then, believe it or not, Shannon, and you'll remember this because we're about the same age, there were no teaching jobs.
No, there was none.
Yeah.
There was none.
And so yeah. I was a teacher's assistant. I made $8 an hour. I was a single mom. I rode the special needs bus for an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon to make an extra $16 a day. And 16 times five happened to be $80. And back then, that's what my son's daycare bill was. And so I was a program assistant. And so finally, after like 3 or 4 years, I landed my first classroom. Yeah. And I felt so privileged and so lucky to be doing the very thing that, you know, I had worked so hard to obtain this degree and be able to work with kids 180 days a year. And I loved it, Shannon. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved it. But there was also, and I think this is just who I am, and I've noticed that about myself, I've just always kind of been that person who just keeps like, okay, now I'm ready to do this. And so I jumped into a literacy coordinator's position for a while. Then I got my administrator's license, and I became a curriculum director, which I love because I love curriculum and I love professional development. And so I did that. And then in 2016, I had had this idea since about 2013 that I wanted to launch my own business. And I did work for a consulting company for a year, which was like, whoo. Oh, let me tell you what, that was a tough, tough thing to do just because my value system didn't line up to theirs, but it taught me so much. And so anyways, I finally decided in 2016, you know what, I'm going to quit my curriculum director's job and I'm going to create Strobel Education. I've had a vision for 3 years. My husband about had a heart attack. He always supports me in everything, but he was super scared because, you know, it was a risk. I didn't know where I was going to find clients or how I was going to make money exactly. And I just kept telling my husband, everything in my body, you talk about signs that we get, right? These whispers, where things are just meant to be. And I said, I know I've got to do it, and I've got to do it in January of 2016. And so he got behind me and we launched Strobel Education. I was a one woman team going out and providing professional development on all kinds of topics. And I guess it's been 8 years now, and I have two girls on my team who go out into the field and provide all kinds of on-site professional development on maybe, you know, 15 different topics, and they do a lot of coaching in schools and curriculum work. And I now mostly do the motivational speaking, so I speak a lot at conferences and schools. And we have online courses. So it's really evolved, which is kind of neat to look back. I don't always take the time to see, because I was just telling my husband at lunch while ago, like, I'm so far behind again. And he's like, Kim, you've been behind for 8 years, you think.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. I'm just gonna say, as soon as you try to do anything new, you're never gonna feel like your head is fully above water, right? It you kind of peek up on the surface, take a look around,
Exactly.
you start sinking a little bit. But what I'm finding really fascinating is, first of all, you epitomize what this podcast is all about, right? It's the idea that you are embracing the messy. Something in your soul told you that you needed to do this, right? And you had to embrace all the messiness, and you still are embracing the messiness of all of this. Now, the book Teach Happy, and you already kind of touched on this, didn't come from you just being a happiness coach. It is also comes from your own personal experience, as you already mentioned, in adolescent and adulthood. And that's your first chapter, from panic to purpose. Great chapter, great chapter, vulnerable chapter. Could you share a bit about that?
Yeah, it is. It's when I think about even when I look back as I was a young girl, Shannon, I was always anxious. And when I now what I know about anxiety disorders, I can kind of see how my brain was always just swirling and working. And so, when I was a young child, I would do kind of things like I would be in fourth grade and I would go outside and I couldn't find my two younger brothers in our neighborhood. And I would immediately kind of panic and run in the house and Mom, I think somebody's taken them. I can't find them. I've searched for them. And she's like, honey, they're playing somewhere. Maybe they went to the park, And so just this like worrisome thing that was in my life. And then in fifth grade, my parents surprised us with a trip to Disney World and my two brothers are excited. And I start to cry. I'm in fifth grade and I'm crying because my parents have told me that we're going to Disney World. And my mom said, what's wrong? And I said, we can't go. What it's such a big place. There's so many people. What if my brothers get lost or what if dad gets lost or what if we can't find one of them or what if they get kidnapped? And, my mom's like, this is not normal behavior, And so I remember she took me to a counselor for a few sessions to try to at least get me a little comfortable going to Disney World. But, while I went, I was just constantly monitoring where everybody in my family was. And then in middle school, it seems like my anxiety kind of always changes or has changed at times. And so in middle school, it kind of became some of the, what would you call it? Maybe the obsessive compulsive, like checking my curling iron multiple times. I would walk to breakfast and go down the hallway and I would say, oh, if you don't touch the wall in this place, your mom's going to pass away today. It's just crazy stuff, right?
Oops, all right.
And so yet, I'm functioning like I'm playing sports. Nobody would ever know anything is wrong with me. It was exhausting to live in my head at times. But it really came to a pivotal moment when I was a sophomore in high school and I was sitting in my English language arts class. And I still remember just sitting there and just within 1 second, it's like everything in the classroom went blurry. My whole body began to just shake out of control. I felt immense fear. I was sweating. I was confused. It's like my brain knew it was in this classroom, but it didn't know why, and everything became disoriented. And I fled the classroom and I went to the nurse's office. And Shannon, that right there started this probably 8 years of just intense suffering because I started to have these episodes they came out of the blue and they were happening multiple times a day and nobody knew what was wrong with me. I got misdiagnosed with low blood sugar. Then they thought I had a seizure disorder. And so long story short, I have always had like this vivacious heart and spirit and wanted to go out into the world and do really big things from the time I was young. I remember having these big visions for my life. And then here I am at, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and I'm struggling to do the most basic of things. I'm struggling to walk one block around my neighborhood by myself, or drive my car 5 minutes to work, or drive to the grocery store. Like, these things became just, I just couldn't hardly do them, because what if I had an episode? What if I started to feel like this? Because when you start to feel like this, you feel very unsafe in your brain, and you don't trust yourself. And so when I would have an episode, I would feel like I needed help immediately. And so I really became agoraphobic. I had to continue to push myself to go to work, but my whole day was just filled with these episodes. And as I tell in the first chapter of the book, my husband at the time, he would leave about 15 minutes before me to go to work, which meant that was 15 minutes of me by myself. And so I would stand in our kitchen where the wall phone was, and I would have my hand on that phone, ready to dial 911 should I need it at any second. And I did that day in and day out, and went to work and felt those fears, felt, finally put my head on the pillow at night just to wake up and start the whole thing again the next day. And anyways, on one particular morning, I walked away from the phone on the wall, and I went to my little tiny bathroom, and I curled up on the bath mat rug. And I just tell people the truth, which is that I asked God to relieve me from my suffering. I didn't want to die, but I felt like the only way to get me out of this was just to give me some relief and remove me from the world so I didn't feel like this. And I remember my cheek being on that plush green bath mat rug, and being curled up and just kind of surrendering to it all. And I always say, I don't know if I feel like I heard a voice, or I somehow got this message, and it said, Kim, get up off that bath mat rug and get some help, because you are made for more. I just remember something about, you are made for more. And I ended up going to a doctor who had an expertise in anxiety disorders. And for the first time in my life, I was told, this is what you have. You're not crazy. This is what's happening in the chemicals of your brain. Now you're hypervigilant, and you're scanning your environment all of the time for whether you're dizzy, do you feel right, do you? And it's causing this cyclic thing happening. And he put me on Zoloft. And Shannon, he put me on Zoloft. He got me into a psychologist who did cognitive behavioral therapy with me for months. And those two things saved my life, and they got my life back, at least, somewhat. And then around the same time, I happened to get my hands on my first self-help book. And here we are, 30 some years later, and I still am reading and absorbing everything I can get my hands on when it comes to how do we create our life from the inside out, and what does that work look like. And I share this story because not everybody has panic disorder, but especially when I get introduced as a happiness coach, and I come onto the stage, and I'm dressed in this dress, and people hear this bio, and oh, she travels across the country, and she does motivational speaking. And I just want to be really real with people right out of the gate, is my life has been messy and hard at times. It's still hard, and what I know about human beings is that while not everyone has panic disorder, almost all of us have had something really difficult to deal with in our life, and might even be going through it right now. So for me, my purpose, I believe, is to take my pain and do something good with it, like plant the seeds of hope that there is a pathway where we can make our lives better, regardless of what has been done to us or what life has thrown at us.
It's such a brave story. I had goosebumps as you were telling it. And you're right. Like, there is so much under the surface that people are hiding, or maybe hiding is not the right word, but suppressing in order to appear confident and to appear like they've got all their crap together, right? It, your story of being in the bathroom, it kind of reminds me of, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Eat, Pray, Love, right? When she has her moment on the bathroom floor and then she hears that voice, get up, Liz, right? There was some bigger purpose that, and I'm so grateful. First of all, I'm so sorry that you had to suffer for so long, but I'm so incredibly grateful that you found the strength to seek the help you did, and that the professionals in your life pointed you to X, Y, and Z so you felt more in control and get your life back, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's so vulnerable and so brave to share that story, because it's, you're like I said, yeah, we all have our own stories.
I have to tell you that that same doctor years later told me that the number one reason he sees people is for the common cold, and the number two reason is for some type of anxiousness, and that his number one clients were school teachers when it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
The anxiety disorder that sometimes even comes just from the overwhelming expectations and demands that are placed on us, which is really why I wanted to write the book, is look, this profession, and I call a spade, it, you know, I think it's one of the most noble, sacred professions. You've been in it for 26 years. You know, you go into this because you want to make an impact. You want to influence these kids. You want to give them hope, and you want to teach them to believe in themselves and to go out into the world and make it a better place. But there are so many outside extenuating circumstances where we get cut down and beat down so quickly by society, by parents, by community. You know, I don't believe that teachers are valued for who they are and what they do day in and day out. And so many times that makes us just feel like that we're not happy anymore doing what we feel called to do. And so I think that we can be happy again, but we got to learn a skill set. And, you know, that's what the book teaches, is like, okay, if you're ready, here's these tiny little steps. It's like a blueprint that's going to help you get your life back in this profession, but also outside of it, because you are more than a teacher and you are more than a school principal. And you have a right to reclaim those other important parts of your life that are also really, really critical to your well-being.
You know, you're absolutely right about the perception of educators. There's this, you know, hyperbolic kind of view that we're, you know, not all heroes wear capes, you know, ready to do everything like we're supposed to do. Wonder Woman, you know, with my bracelets, you know, like when I was little, my sister used to dress me up like Wonder Woman. And it's, you know, and we're supposed to just let everything, we're supposed to be like Teflon and everything just, you know, goes and flies off of us. And then there's so much shame around then trying to seek out help. That was my story, right? Before I got diagnosed with depression. And it was actually not sadness that I needed to get treated for. It was actually more, I mean, grief was part of it, doing the, you know, due to the loss and stuff that was going on in my own building in my district at the time. But it was the shame around it. Like, you know, how long does it take? You know, how many teachers do you hear about who say that they're, you know, they're just going to push themselves until spring break, right? We just another couple weeks, we're going to be right there, and we're going to be, you know, it's going to be summer holidays, right? And we got to take care of ourselves now. And I think that's what's so beautiful again about your story and about that first chapter is, yo, educators, reality check, right? You cannot do this job in the way that you want to unless you take care of yourself. Now, I love this idea that the book Teach Happy is a blueprint, small steps that teachers can make in order to become happier. So how do you, Kim, define happiness?
Yeah. You know, there's so many versions and definitions. And first and foremost, here's what I know. And I've learned a lot of this from Arthur Brooks, and he wrote Build the Life. I have it on my shelf. Build the Life.
I know which
you
book
want.
You're talking. Yes. I know that one. It's great.
And I think he explains it really well. He basically says, look, you know, happiness is not like some end goal that you finally reach where you go, you know what? I'm finally happy in my life. I've arrived. I've made it. And what he says, which really resonates with me, is that we are all a mixture of happy and unhappy, right? And even day to day, like this morning, Shannon, I woke up and I was super happy. I went and did my meditation. And then my dog barked for 30 minutes outside while I was meditating. So then I went to unhappy, right? Then she comes flying back in and jumps on my lap and I'm back to happy again. And then I wrote my gratitude list and got myself back to happy. Then I opened my email and saw that we had like 3 fires and we needed to put those out. So then I'm back to unhappiness again, right? Then I go do my workout and I'm like, oh, I'm feeling good again. So like understanding that this is not like this idea where you finally arrive and you're all good. And I think that's a misinterpretation. Yeah. And that's why we all feel like, gosh, I'm just not there yet. And I'm never going to get there. So first, just understanding that happiness is, like Arthur says, it's a direction that we're headed in, but it's not a definition or a destination. And then also understanding, though, that believe it or not, we all have the ability to get happier. And that means several things, right? It means really and truly having enjoyment in our life. Do we have enjoyment and passion and fun and laughter and things that make us feel good? Do we have fulfillment? Are you working and achieving, maybe not achieving, but are you working towards something that is bigger than you? Do you have purpose in your life? Do you have a vision for it? I think it's kind of like all of these little puzzle pieces together, but what we know is it's not really a feeling. It's this idea of, for me, I kind of call it like the happiness house. So like if you picture me as a house, I have intentional happiness habits that are a part of my everyday life. So while I might get unhappy or I might go in the gutter, I have a set of skills, a foundation now built around this idea of living a happier life that I get out of the gutter quicker than I used to.
I like the chart that you put in the book that shows, you know, where our happiness comes from, right? Like that it's, you know, yes, part of it is genetics, right? And that the other part, another part is thoughts, actions, and behaviors. And then what I found really fascinating is that in your chart, you have external circumstances is 10%. And it's so fascinating that a mere 10% of our happiness and our day-to-day lives can revolve and be consumed around the details of that 10%.
Yes. You know,
that the negative or even the positive, right? That just becomes kind of overwhelms us.
It does. Yeah. And I love that chart in the book that is based on happiness research, because it basically says that we all have what's called a baseline happiness level. So my baseline might be here, and maybe your baseline is a couple notches above mine. And what that means, Shannon, is that good things might happen in our life. Like, you know, I don't know, maybe we, you know, get a new job, or we get our degree, or we go on vacation, or we go shopping for the day, whatever it is. And our happiness level goes up for a period of time, but it's always going to reset right back to the baseline. It's going to come back to that baseline.
It's not long lasting. It's not part of the habit or the routine that we need to actually get into to help maintain our happiness.
Yes. And so the same is true for when bad things happen in our life. We actually know that as humans, it's been proven over and over again by the research that we can endure trauma and loss and illness and disease and just hardships, and our happiness levels will drop for a period of time, but they do reset back to baseline.
Yeah.
And then people go, but Kim, why is Shannon's happiness baseline higher than yours? Where does it come from? And just like you said, it shows in the book that 50% of our long-term happiness is genetic. It comes from our mom or dad or a mixture of both. And I'm not going to lie, Shannon, I'm into epigenetics a little bit. I actually think we can alter which genes we turn on and off, but
sure.
I'm not going to fight with Sonia Lubomirsky on this just yet. So we're going to go with the 50% that is genetic. And then, like you said, only 10% of our long-term happiness comes from our external circumstances. You know, that's like, what kind of family did you grow up in? Were your parents married, single, divorced, or widowed? Were you bullied in school? You know, what happened to you as an adult? What kind of home do you live in now? Are you married, single, divorced? All these things are these external circumstances. We can throw them all together. And the research shows that it only accounts for about 10% of long-term happiness. But if you're like Kim Strobel, you let things like the fact that 3 fires needed to be put out in my business this morning, I'm just going to tell you what, that stole way more than 10% of my happiness.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you let people steal more, you know, some of us let people steal more than 10% of our happiness for years and years.
Is the key not to just let that consume you then? And to try to think about that 40%, right?
Yeah, well, let's be honest, Shannon. If something happens that is, like, if my husband tells me today he's leaving me, I can tell you that way more than my 10% of my happiness is going to be stolen for a while, and as it rightfully should. So this is not about just saying, oh, well, it's just 10%. So no, right? There are things that happen. The issue is when we're looking at the big picture of your happiness, your long-term happiness. And yes, when you let things or people or circumstances steal that for way too long. That's where I tell people, we really do have to take 100% responsibility for our life, because the bottom line is unfair things have happened, unjust things, for some people, the unimaginable. And even sometimes I think, I don't know, there could be some things that happened that maybe I don't think I would ever get my happiness back. Mm-hmm. But I know people who do, Shannon. I just read the book by Eddie. I can't think of his last name, but he wrote The Happiest Man on Earth. And he was a Holocaust survivor who like endured the unimaginable.
Yeah.
And over and over and over in the book, he just says, I had to let go. I had to let go of the hatred. I had to let go of the anger. I could not let what had happened to me steal the rest of the happiness that was available to me.
Yeah.
So then that leaves 40%. And that's the part that Kim Strobel focuses on. Yeah. Every single one of us has the ability to increase our happiness levels by up to 40%.
So it's not denying or washing over the negative stuff that does happen to us. It's acknowledging it, but not lying in bed with it forever, right?
Yes.
And letting us consume. Now, you go on to talk about toxic positivity. Okay.
Yeah.
You hear that. It's a buzzword, right? Mm-hmm. What's the difference between toxic positivity and healthy positivity?
Well, I think, for example, educators are sick of being told to take care of themselves. Like, you know, everybody's preaching that, but the bottom line is, and I write about this in the book too, is, you know, self-care is an overused word. And like, I remember one time being called to speak to a group of 900 at the end of a day and to tell them to practice more self-care. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. I mean, I'm going to look out at 900 weary faces who have answered 5,296 questions today, and I'm going to tell them that they need to start taking better care of themselves. Like, honestly, that's toxic positivity a little bit, because one thing is we have to redefine what self-care looks like. And I call it radical wellness.
Yeah.
because it's hot and it's messy and it requires you to do things that are uncomfortable. And that's the only way that we really learn to take care of ourselves. And so, you know, this idea of taking a hot lavender bath or going and getting a pedicure or, you know, breathing five times during the school day, whatever, that's fine, but that's not going to make your job less hard come Monday morning. And so I also think for me, getting up on a stage and getting everybody fired up and inspired with the science of happiness was great. But I also felt like I'm not really telling them how to, like, I'm getting them excited and I'm giving them a few strategies, but I really want them to make change in their life. And I think that's kind of where the book came in. It's like, okay, you want to know the exact steps I use to do this? Here it is, right here in this book, you know. But I think that we've been told that we're not allowed to feel our heavy feelings. And, you know, like, you're not allowed to feel sad. Shannon, you have so much to be thankful for in your life, sweetheart.
Yeah.
That's toxic positivity.
My skin crawls. Someone comes up to me and says, everything will be okay.
Oh.
I'm like, just can please just piss off. You know, you know, can you, like, that's the worst thing you could tell me. If I am enduring something and I'm feeling all the feelings, whether I'm really sad and really angry, and someone says, everything will be okay and you've got this. No, no, please. I would rather you sit down beside me and go, you know what? That friggin' sucks.
Exactly.
That really sucks. Tell me some more about that. You know, I don't want to hear everything will be okay, right? That's not what I need right now, right? And so that takes me to this idea. I think this is the good segue into this idea of questioning, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking about, you know, how can we, when we're in situations on the other side, instead of saying we're going to look at everybody and go, everything will be okay, we actually ask questions that offers them an opportunity to either let it out, or they might say, I just want time by myself, just leave me alone, and respecting that, right? Yeah. And not feeling hurt because someone says they don't want to talk about it or they don't want to answer these questions. But it reminds me of a book I just read, a book called Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg. And it is about asking those questions that, you know, acknowledges their feelings and acknowledges what they're going through. You know, it's kind of like when you tell me more. Or
that's it.
You know, like Air Francis.
And we don't do that, right? We like,
what do you mean? Tell me more, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of feeling like, okay, I'm here to help fix you.
Exactly. And I think that we all do toxic positivity with good intentions, but it's kind of this idea too, when we're like, look, give it your all. Kids deserve your very best. Be the best you can be for the students. Now you get in those classrooms and, you know, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know what? I wanna walk in and be what I need to be to my kids. But I actually think it needs to be, you know what, teachers, let me show you, because you don't know how to do this, because you've had years and years of downloaded social scripts that have said, not only are you not allowed to take care of yourself, but you also are supposed to never, you know, say yes to everything, be a people pleaser, never upset anyone, look pretty, smile pretty, act like everything's great. When in all reality, that is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. And I always say, like, I'm all for the students and I want us to be there for those students. But you know what? I want to teach teachers how to be there for themselves first. And so that's toxic positivity sometimes too. And again, we do it for the right reasons. We're trying to get everybody fired up, but, you know, and then we're just, you know, or you get called into the principal's office and you're like, look, this is the second year I've had the most challenging kids. And then the principal goes, but Kim, you're just so good with those kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, come on. That is so not right. That is so not fair to me. That's toxic positivity. Whereas, like, healthy positivity is that, you know, there are strategies that we can use to rewire our brain. Because what we hyper-focus on grows. And so if I'm constantly focused on all the ugliness sometimes of my job, right? Like, for example, the parent who shames you for something. You know, I mean, I remember one time I had a parent who marked up a newsletter that I sent home and said, "Well, my goodness, you made two mistakes here." But yet, my little Mackenzie, she missed two on her writing because she made a mistake, but her own teacher's making mistakes. It's like, oh, you know, the silliness. I mean, I know every educator listening knows, Kim, I got 17 stories that look just like that, you know? And so, again, it's healthy positivity is, yes, being able to reframe that after it's done and saying, I'm not letting that person steal anymore. I felt the feels. I'm ticked off about it. But I also understand that she doesn't get a right to take up any more space in my head. So I'm going to go exercise. I'm going to do something that gets my brain off of this, you know?
And it's about us. We can't rely on anybody else to fix this for us, right? Like we can't pour from an empty cup, but it's up to us to fill up the cup. If we're going to sit and wait for our administrative team or our district to install an initiative, to that it's going to, fix the problem of with teacher self-care, it's not going to happen. The other thing is, it's made me think about what you're saying is we're not doing any favors to students if we're role modeling what we don't want to have happen to them in the future, no matter what occupation, what happens to them in the future. By actually modeling that kind of vulnerability and actually sharing with them that, okay, I just need a second. Okay. And you know what? Right now I'm going to put my hand on my heart and my other hand on my belly. I'm going to take a deep breath. And if there's anybody else in the classroom who wants to do this with me, feel free to do this with me. Okay, we've got this. This is a hard day, but we've got each other, and seeing that and showing kids that, I'm not Teflon. I'm not the superhero. I'm not, I'm perfectly imperfect. I'm messy, and I want them to feel like they can be messy around me as well, right? I think,
Yeah, that's
do
so
you get what
important.
I'm, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the
And I get
thing.
that that's not the mess, like that's not the message of your book, but it's like a
Well, it
residual
is
kind of
that we
thing.
must share our vulnerabilities with our students in order to teach them. It's not just about creating readers and writers and mathematicians. We
Exactly.
want those
Yeah.
students to leave our classrooms and be really good at life. And in order to do that, we have to learn. I mean, nobody ever taught me self-regulation, techniques back in the day, or how to resolve conflict, or no, I was never taught those skills. My parents didn't have those skills. And so, part of our responsibility, I do think, is modeling our own vulnerability with our students so that they understand. I mean, they're under immense pressure at times too.
How does gratitude play into this idea of helping us become happier?
Yeah. Well, when we're thinking of that 40% that is in our control that we can work on to increase our happiness levels by up to 40%, it has to do with our thoughts, our actions, and our behavior. So every strategy in the book is aligned to either the thoughts you're thinking, the habits, the actions that you're taking, or the behaviors that you have. And all three of those are just our habits, right? And so one of the top five happiness habits that's going to give you a really big bump in your happiness is the practice of gratitude. And so here's why it works. First of all, if you're an average human being, you're having about 70,000 thoughts a day. 70,000, Shannon. Now, if you're an average human being, what we know is that 80% of those thoughts are negative. Which means when you put your head on the pillow at night, you've had around 56,000 negative thoughts in a day's time. And what's even crazier is of the 80% of thoughts that are negative today, 95% of that 80% are the exact same thoughts you had the day before. The reason being is that most of this is firing from our subconscious mind, and the thoughts are firing so fast that we're not even aware of them. I mean, there's no way we could be aware of 56,000 thoughts, right? And so the reason our brains are wired like this is it actually comes from caveman, cavewoman times when we had this thing called the amygdala in our brain. And the amygdala has one job and one job only, which is to scan its environment for negativity or danger in order to keep us safe. The issue is that it's 2024 and we still have an amygdala. And Shannon, you and I aren't looking but behind our back right now to see if there's a saber-toothed tiger headed our way. We're not worried if we're going to have a water source to keep us alive for the next 3 days. And we don't think that anybody's going to ride in on horses and slit our throat, okay? But we still have an amygdala, and it still functions the way it did thousands of years ago, which is to scan for danger and negativity. So it's not our fault. It's not our fault that we have all these thoughts. But what we know from the practice of gratitude is that when I can teach people to write down just three different things they're thankful for every single day, what happens is I begin to create a new neural feedback loop in your brain. So if you have a loop in your brain that you go down all the time, which is, I'm so sick of my job, I'm so sick of these parents, I'm sick of not getting paid enough, I'm sick, like those are all valid, right? But like if you have ill thoughts about your job, 720 ill thoughts today about your job. Tomorrow, you're going to have 735 ill thoughts about your job because you keep strengthening those neurons, right? Because neurons that fire together wire together. And so you have this pathway that you keep going down easier and easier and easier. But when you write down three different things, all of a sudden, your brain starts to take a little bit of a different pathway. And it keeps going and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And so all of a sudden, then your brain starts to shift a little bit from pessimism to optimism. It starts to see more good than bad. And when your brain does that, when we see it tip just over a little bit, that's when everything starts to shift in your life. It really does, because perspective is everything. And so when we teach you how to do that, we actually teach you to rewire your brain. And when we rewire your brain, you start to experience more happiness. It's just amazing. It's such an easy 2 minute daily practice, but I am telling you, it makes such an astounding difference in a person's life.
I believe it. I love the analogy of, like, you know, Plato's three-legged stool, mind, body, and spirit, right? And when we show gratitude, right, we are, you know, helping with our spiritual self. When we exercise, we're helping with our body, right? And of course, when we're like, when we're mindful and we need meditation and mindfulness, right, that's taking care of our mind, giving it a rest. And when we don't do that, the stool is off balance, right? Because it's got three legs. And it's not necessarily about it being of equal measure, right? It's doesn't necessarily have to be balance as we come to know it as, you know, 33 1/3%, 33 1/3%, 33 1/3%, right? But as long as you take part in each of those three things, you are going to feel, what's the word? Better. Like
you will feel happier.
More happier. Yeah, there you go, right? That's the book. You are going to feel happier. And I know in my own practice, you know, sometimes I have to force myself to do those things, right? One of the things I do with my students is Thankful Thursdays on Thursdays, right? We do smiles and frowns every day. We do Thankful Thursdays, and I'll model that for the kids, right? Someone I'm thankful for. And then we talk about how saying it out loud is one thing because we are surrounded by so much negativity. And it's important that we talk about things that are positive. Even if you're just thinking about it right now, that's an important step. And then, if you take it a step further and you actually reach out to a person and you say, hey, today, Thankful Thursday, Kim, I was really grateful that you reached out to me, right? And like you smiled a little more, right? Like people go, no, and more often than not, when we show gratitude, the other person is like, man, I needed to hear that today.
Oh, yes. And I
Such a
love that you do this.
win-win-win.
I love that you do this with your students. I tell people, I always, started every day with 90 seconds of gratitude, and we just went around the room. And 90 seconds later, we had 27 gratitudes. At the end of the day, they pull their notebooks out. They write the words, I am thankful at the top, and they list three gratitudes because, again, this is a good at life type of practice. And by the way, if your listeners want, I do have a gratitude prompt and tracker. I can give you
Oh,
the link to that, Shannon. And if they
yes.
download that, what it's going to do is it's going to give them five different areas to start looking for gratitude in their life. But they don't have to write five gratitudes, they just have to write three. But if you use these prompts, it's going to start pinging your brain. And then there is a 21-day tracker you can use. Personally, I just love a good journal. But you can use the gratitude prompt and tracker with your students. You can use it yourself, and I'll send you the link, and I'm sure you'll drop it in the
Perfect.
show notes. And
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to say. I will put it in the show notes because anything that's, like I, it's nice when someone else has put the work through in developing these nice things and sharing is caring, right? We share it and then we use it and we're all going to win.
I
Oh,
just
love
got a
that.
message from I gave this talk to 6,000 people in Phoenix this past summer, and I just got a message from one of the teachers who started the gratitude practice with her students. And here she is. She emailed me like 6 months later, and she just said, Kim, you wouldn't believe what an effect this is having on my students. And I was just like, oh my gosh, they actually took action and actually implemented it. And I loved hearing the success that she
And
was
she
seeing.
told you.
I
That's
know
another
she took
thing
the
right
time to
there,
write me the
too.
most endearing email. Yes.
Oh, that's,
Because, right,
oh.
that's what you're talking about. She sent an email
Yes.
of gratitude to me.
Yeah. And like I said, it doesn't take any time, right? I'm walking down the hallway and I'll notice, someone's door open and just be like, hi, good morning. Have a great day, when I could just keep going, beeline it for my door, that gratitude. And that brings me to thinking about, relationships, right? And how when we form these bonds with other people, it can make us stronger mentally and it can make us happier. Do you want to touch on that a little bit there?
Yeah, I mean, social connections is one of the top five too. And I know your listeners, here's the deal. Most teachers are type A personality, so they're sitting there listening and they're going, "Can you just tell us what the top five are, Kim? You keep saying the top five." So I'll real quickly tell you what they
Sure,
are.
yeah.
So, of course, gratitude, social connections, which we're getting ready to talk about, exercise, move your body 30 minutes a day. And there's a whole chapter that gives you the why behind that, which just is shocking to me. I've always been an exerciser, Shannon, but I never knew that literally by exercising, I was changing the mitochondria in my cells. And you, if you are a consistent exerciser, you take off 9 years of your life. So like throw away the face mask and just start exercising, right? Like if you want to look 9 years younger. So exercise and then random acts of kindness and meditation. So those are the top five. But this one, social connections, relationships is so important. And I think that we found that out when we hit COVID and many of us were holed up in our homes. It has reminded us that there's a reason why people met and sat on porches and had talks and took the time at the end of the evening to reconnect with their partner, why they sat in a lawn chair. And I know my husband and I are empty nesters now, but one of our favorite things to do, which we are so excited the weather is changing, is we will go sit on our deck for an hour or two and we'll just look at the woods and we'll talk about life. And I know some of people are listening are going like, Kim, I got three kids right now in 17 different activities. I understand that like they don't have that, but you got 5 minutes. You got 5 minutes just to sit down with no TV and say, guess what, babe? I want to know what was good about your day today or what was hard. And it really, it's those little tiny things that make all the difference. And I'm not always real good at like social connections when it comes to friends, because I work really hard, Shannon. And at the end of the week on a Friday night, I don't want to go out to eat. I want to like veg out with Netflix and just lose myself in Outlander for 2 hours, you know?
Yes.
but I'm learning to invest a little bit more in those because the happiness research is so, so strong when it comes to that.
I had two quick stories. So the first one is a couple of years ago, I sold my car to my daughter. My husband and I decided to start carpooling. And every time I consider buying myself my own car, it's not actually, it's such a positive impact on the environment, first of all, to carpool. But second of all, I drive to work and from work every day with my husband. Right. And I'm almost an empty nester. My oldest one, you know, house sits a lot, works a lot. My son's at law school. So we sit down at dinner and talk, and we still, you know, sit at the dinner table, and we're not like just on TV trays in the living room, which it serves its purpose. There's probably once a week where we do that as well, but we have that. The other one is a while ago, and I think it started loosely a little bit during COVID, is on Friday evenings, I would send a text to everyone, a bunch of people in my, I want to connect with. And it was like me with a glass of wine, happy Friday, or, you know, depending on the weekend, here's the spring break or whatever it is. And now it's like a Friday thing. And then it's the cutest thing, because some people will text me first and, I beat you to it kind of thing. You know, I texted you first. And then if I miss a Friday, I'm like, oh, I missed your Friday. You know, oh, love your Fridays. And I don't know, it's so simple. All
what
you have
a
to
fun
do is
way
pose
to,
for
yes.
a couple minutes, you know, and then I go through and I just text and text and text and text and text. And it's just my Friday.
I love
thing,
it. That's
right?
A great way to connect.
It's
my
just
friend.
A neat thing.
Yeah. My friend Mary does that with her three kids. I think that there's a mandatory text like that she sends out at the end of the week where there's three kids. And so they all share what was something that went well for them this week, you know? And I was like, and she goes, it just helps us maintain that bond with each other, knowing a little bit about what's going on in each other's life. And we all know at the end of the week, we'll be texting one another and just making that connection. So I love that idea of what you're doing.
Yeah. So I'll be getting your cell number at the end of this session. I'm going to be putting you on my list there, Kim. Like, this is such a wonderful topic to talk about, right? Like, it's happiness is just so beautiful and it's energizing. And like, all I've done is feel moved and smile. And so I'm sad that our conversation is slowly coming to an end. Are you ready for elevator pitch?
Yeah. I forgot what it is, but go for it.
That's okay. That's okay. So elevator pitch is what I do with all of my guests. So here's the situation. Okay. So you're on the third floor, Kim, and someone's going to walk on and they're going to ask you about something. And the idea is that you've only got three floors. So as the elevator is moving up to floor from 3 to 6 to answer this question. Okay. So I made a mistake. You're on floor 5, and an educator gets on the elevator and presses 8. They tell you that they read Teach Happier and are a big fan of you and your work. They ask, what is your favorite personal small change you've instilled in your own life that has made you happier and hopeful?
Well, I just have to tell you, I attribute so much of my growth to a therapist that I've worked on and off with for 20 years. And you know what? I just have to say this. I think that everybody, therapists, That's kind of a negative word. Okay, I'm going to go way more than four floors.
Yeah,
But
you go ahead.
here's
It's
the deal.
the elevator's broken down a bit, so
Yeah,
yeah.
but it's like therapist, we think we only go when we have something wrong. My therapist is part therapist, part life coach, part spiritual mentor. And I call him the great potentializer because life is too hard to figure out on our own. And I get in my own way. So when I need to change my actions or I need to change my behaviors, I really can't figure it out on my own because I'm operating in my own limited, you know. And so for me, that I say you have to work on yourself. And I'll probably be 95 years old and I'm still going to be working on Kim Strobel because she's worth it. Because every time I work on myself, this evolved, better version of myself comes to the forefront. And so I would just say, like, you know, for me, honestly, having this person in my life who's helped me, like, kind of mine for the golden gems that are down there that I didn't even know were there and to bring them to life. Because I will say, Shannon, I wake up every day excited to live my life. It's not perfect, but every day I'm excited to live it. And I really want to inspire others to do the same.
Well, you've inspired this teacher right here.
Thank you.
I am so grateful that you stepped into my life,
Aww.
You know, and the book, again, it's a beautiful book. It is called Teach Happier.
Teach Happy.
Listeners. Teach Happy.
Teach Happy, Small Steps to Big Joy.
Your next book. No, I'm just joking. I mean, Teach Happier. No. Teach Happy. And we're all going to be happier for it. And I can't wait to hear where this journey takes you. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Shannon.
I'm honored to have produced this and all episodes of the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Shinkle on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Tlalaytene First Nation. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share it with a colleague or friend. Doing so will help others find the podcast. Know someone who embraces the messy and would make a great guest on the pod? Email me at embracethemessypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and see you next time.